4. Marty Ginsburg's favorite subject. Remarks introducing Justice Ginsburg, September 25, 2003. As Marty Ginsburg recounts in the following piece, it was during her first year at Cornell that Ruth Bader, then 17, met the man who would become first her best friend and then her husband and life partner. Marty Ginsburg, 18 and a sophomore, was handsome, gregarious, brilliant, and brash. He met freshman Ruth on a blind double date orchestrated by Marty's roommate Mark, who was dating a housemaid of Ruth's, did not own a car, and wanted Marty to drive all four of them to a formal dance. As you will hear in Marty's remarks, he was struck by Ruth's beauty from the very beginning, and as he told us in an interview many years later, he quickly realized that she was more than just attractive. "I did not know she was also smart, but I discovered that when we had a second date, and it came through to me that not only was she really smart, but unlike most of the smart first-year girls who hadn't yet decided to suppress their intelligence, and there were a few of those, she wasn't glib. I don't remember who said it first, but it's such a wonderful line and so accurate. Ruth is somebody who is simply not afraid of dead air time. If you ask her a question that requires a thought-through answer, she will stop, think it through, and then answer it. She has done that for the 54 years I have known her. She still does it at dinner." For her part, Ruth called Marty the first guy ever interested in me because of what was in my head. Marty was an unusual man for the 1950s. Not only was he not threatened by Ruth's intelligence, but he actively encouraged and took pride in her academic and professional pursuits. As Ruth explained, "He's so secure about himself. He never regarded me as any kind of threat to his ego. On the contrary, he took great pride in being married to someone he considered very able. According to Ruth, Marty always made me feel I was better than I thought I was, that I could accomplish whatever I sought. He had enormous confidence in my ability, more than I had in myself." Despite meeting on a blind date, their relationship remained platonic for some time because Ruth had a boyfriend who attended Columbia Law School and Marty a girlfriend at Smith College. But they soon became best friends, drawn together by shared intellectual interests and abilities, and were delighted to discover that they both loved opera, a passion shared by few of their peers. After Marty gave up his chemistry major because the afternoon science labs interfered with his golf team practice, he and Ruth enrolled in several of the same classes. Taking classes together was a strategic choice for Marty. Not only could he spend more time with Ruth, but he could also rely on her meticulous notes when he cut class. Having already become such close friends, once Ruth and Marty became romantically involved, it did not take them long to realize that they wanted to marry and spend their lives together. Instead of one aha moment, it was more like a steady crescendo. In Marty's words, "When did I decide it would be a sensible idea that Ruth and I should spend the rest of our time together? I don't know, but I can assure you it was long before she did." It was clear to Marty early on that I obviously was going to have a much better and much happier life with Ruth than without her. And when he proposed to Ruth, "I think we were in the car at the time," he recalls, "she answered with a resounding yes." They were married in June 1954, weeks after Ruth graduated from Cornell and Marty finished his first year at Harvard Law School. Decades later, Ruth said, "It was the best decision I ever made." Introduction by Martin Ginsburg of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. 20th Anniversary of Women's Law and Public Policy Fellowship Program. Georgetown University Law Center, September 25th, 2003.
Well, as you heard, I am involved in the tax law, and when Wendy Williams and Mary Hartnett asked me to speak, at what they said was appropriate length on what they termed my favorite subject. Naturally, I prepared a lengthy discourse addressing the Supreme Court's performance in tax cases. Sadly, Wendy reacted with unexpected hostility, and so instead I am going to speak a few minutes only about my wife with Honorable Ruth. But you are the losers, because I promise you the Supreme Court's performance in tax cases is exceedingly funny. We travel a lot. Our travels, like our life in the District of Columbia, afford memorable moments. In December 2000, just after Bush against Gore, Ruth and I were in New York City to see the play Proof. And after the first act intermission, as we walked down the aisle to our seats, what seemed like the entire audience began to applaud. Many stood. Ruth beamed. I beamed too, leaned over and whispered loudly, "I bet you didn't know there's a convention of tax lawyers in town." Well, without changing her bright smile, Ruth smacked me right in the stomach. But not too hard, and I give you this picture because it fairly captures our nearly 50-year happy marriage, during which I have offered up an astonishing number of foolish pronouncements with absolute assurance. And Ruth, with only limited rancor, has ignored almost everyone. A few years ago, speaking of Ruth, who in 1972 was his first Columbia Law School tenure hire, Mike Sovereign, former dean and president of Columbia, marvelously commented that he had known Ruth for so long, it had begun before either of them was worth cultivating. I'm not sure that was really true about Ruth and Mike, but it certainly fits Ruth and me. We met as undergraduates at Cornell University on a blind date in 1950. She newly arrived and I 1 year ahead. The truth is, it was a blind date only on Ruth's side. I cheated. I asked a classmate to point her out in advance. Oh, she's really cute, I perceptively noticed. And then after a couple of evenings out, I added, "And boy, she's really, really smart." And of course, I was right on both counts. And in the intervening 53 years, nothing changed. I will skip over those intervening years because you are old friends and you know about us. And indeed, if you are not all old friends, you likely know the essentials. Courtesy of an interview, our dear daughter, Jane, a serpent's tooth, if ever there was, volunteered to the press a decade ago. All smile, Professor Jane announced she had grown up in a home in which responsibility was equally divided. Her father did the cooking, she explained, and her mother did the thinking. It was Jane's press statement that convinced me truth should not be allowed as a defense in defamation actions. 20 years ago, in celebrating Ruth's then 50th birthday, her D.C. Circuit clerks asked lots of Ruth's friends and acquaintances to write, "When I think of Ruth Bader Ginsburg," letters for compilation in a book of warm recollections. Jane, for example, contributed what she described as mother's extraordinary pot roast recipe. It was horrifyingly accurate and extraordinarily funny. Ruth is no longer permitted in the kitchen. This by the demand of our children who have taste. To my mind, however, the very best letter was contributed by Anita Escudero, my wonderful secretary from pre-teaching days when I was a New York City lawyer. Anita, who I should explain, was the world's fastest typist. She had been a world-class flamenco dancer in her youth. Think about that. in any event, she wrote from what was special personal experience of the impact of Ruth's 1970s efforts to advance gender equality. And because her letter is far better than anything I might write or ever have, I propose to read in its brief entirety this previously unpublished grand testimonial to my wife's prejudicial influence on American life. When I think of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, I think of the words sexual and gender. Gender-based discrimination was a book I typed for her when I arrived in New York. I had been in New York only a very short time. Born in Arizona, I lived most of my life in Spain and South America. My family needed money, and I got a job in a law firm typing in the steno pool. One morning, RBG's husband walked in and handed me 100 pages of handwritten material dealing with sex discrimination, abortion, and so on. I was horrified. The words female and male loomed out at me. I had never seen or heard them used the way she used them. I had never even thought about those distinctions. I started typing. Over the next few months, in walked this shirt-sleeved lawyer with his yellow pad of handwritten notes on this nonsensical subject of sex discrimination. Poverty abounded in great America, and I kept typing. One morning, the shirt-sleeved lawyer announced, "My wife is coming in." I thought, "Good God, here she comes, the weird one." In walked this little 5-foot, 100-pound woman with a soft voice wearing a green dashiki, and I thought, it can't be the same woman. She's not supposed to look like that. She's supposed to look like George Sand. Where's the cigar? The fly on her pants. I kept typing. I went to Sevilla, Spain, on vacation with my family, where I have a home. We were invited to a large cocktail party, and the room was full of males and females. In walked Anita with her husband. The host presented him, Don Mario Escudero. Don Mario, in turn, said, "Esta es mi mujer." This is my woman. I threw my chest out and said, "I am not your woman. I am a person." My name is Anita Loise Ramos Mosterio de Escudero. From the back of the room boomed the host's 80-year-old grandmother, "Viva America." I had been converted through typing. Well, whether through typing, reading, listening, arguing, Ruth's work in the 1970s as a teacher and a litigator converted multitudes, including, as we all know, that largest of multitudes, a majority of the Supreme Court. Had Ruth in 1980, at age 47, retired to a life of TV and bonbons, she would have enjoyed a significant place in 20th century history, although with those bonbons, a rather fat place. Well, of course, she did not retire. or get fat. She went on to better work. 13 years on the D.C. Circuit, where, to take but one example, her efforts on behalf of the ICC's filed rate doctrine will never be forgotten. Rather more important work over the past 10 years at the Marble Palace, efforts on behalf of everyone. Everyone, I guess, except the ICC, long departed. In all events, we celebrate this evening a grand performance born of great intelligence, fine judgment, personal warmth, unremitting hard work, and an advantageous marriage. Which is just what I expected after our second date 53 years ago. The next decade, with only a little luck, I am sure will be even better. I introduce to you the Honorable Ruth Ginsburg.